Welcome to Acoustic Music Talk, where we explore the art of acoustic music and musicians with your host, Brad Apple.
Well, hello, folks, and welcome to Acoustic Music Talk, the podcast. I'm your host, Brad Apple. We have a wonderful show lined out for you this week. As our guest, we have Miss Becky Buller. And Becky and her band have been blazing the bluegrass trails as of recent years and turning out some great performances and recordings along the way. Becky and I got to sit down recently and have a good conversation by telephone, and we got to talk about a lot of things and aspects of Becky's career, including her songwriting, which she is a great songwriter. Her songs have been recorded by a virtual who's who in the bluegrass community, and we get to talk about her band and her latest singles. So let's go ahead and get into our conversation with Miss Becky Buller. Again, thank you, Becky, for being on the show today, and you've done a lot of great things and continue to do a lot of great things in bluegrass music. We sure look forward to talking to you. Just wondering if you could maybe start out with telling us how you got started in playing music.
Sure. Brad, thank you for having me. Thank you to everybody that's tuned in. I have been playing bluegrass music since I was a kid. My parents got just fell in love with bluegrass when I was about 5 years old. They were at the Butterfield Threshing Bee in Butterfield, Minnesota, and heard a bluegrass band playing, and my dad decided he wanted to learn how to play the mandolin. And, you know, one thing led to another. My parents both played guitar already at that point, and it wasn't long after that that they started a band called Prairie Grass with another couple, Gordy and Roxy Schultz, and they played together the entire time that I was growing up, and I joined them when I was about 11, 12, somewhere in there, but when I was about 9 or 10, I started bugging them for fiddle lessons because I really wanted to sing in their band. And they said, you have to play something because everybody plays something in a bluegrass band. And so I, you know, looked at their lineup and said, well, you don't have a fiddle. I didn't know about dobro at that point. So I might have wound up a dobro player if I'd known about that. But I definitely knew about fiddles. And so I said, well, okay, I'll play fiddle. And it took about a year to convince them that I was serious. And they got me violin lessons. We didn't have any fiddle teachers in my area, but there's a wonderful woman, Patty Trias, became my teacher. For about 6 years, I studied with her at the Mankato Suzuki School of Music in Mankato, Minnesota. She's a wonderful teacher. She's still at it up there. And she taught me some fiddle tunes on the side, which I really appreciate because she knew that that's what I really wanted to do. And then I learned a lot off of records and stuff. And I just feel so grateful that I learned both the bluegrass fiddling discipline alongside the classical violin discipline, because there's just so many great things that one adds to the other. You know, I already had note reading from playing piano, but you know, the technique that you get from learning classical violin is just really helpful. And then of course the ear training that you get playing bluegrass music is great. I mean, as theory, my first year of college, I did music theory, and man, that was a breeze because of all my ear training from bluegrass music. So I'm just really grateful that I can draw from both disciplines when I teach, because I just feel like, you know, that's really helpful to the students. But yeah, I really got into bluegrass music as a singer. I wanted to sing, and to this day I approach fiddling like that. I've always been more interested in how the fiddle works in a band situation and backing up a song. I've been more interested in that than the tunes. I probably don't know enough tunes. I'm always telling my husband I'm not a real fiddle player because I don't know enough waltzes, and I don't chase rattlesnakes, and I don't deal in fiddles or work on fiddles or trade fiddles all the time. You know, but I've always been more focused. I mean, I focus on my instruments, of course, but more focused on the songwriting and the singing aspect of it. But right. And I went to bluegrass school. I'm almost through with my story. I went to bluegrass school in Johnson City, Tennessee, at East Tennessee State University. They have the oldest program of its kind anywhere in the world. It's the Bluegrass Old Time Country Music Program, started by Jack Cottle in the early 1980s, And that brought me to Tennessee in 97 when I graduated from high school, and I've been here ever since.
Awesome. Well, I appreciate that you know the note reading side and the classically trained side of things. I think that's really neat because, I mean, I don't do that, and I know a lot of musicians don't that have learned by ear. But I think that's really neat to have, too, because, you know, I got into old-time music also several years ago, and through that I learned that Norman Blake, you know, he reads notes and stuff, too, and he finds a lot of those old songs that he ended up doing and recording, you know, in books and stuff, so... That's pretty cool.
It's really helpful. I wish I was more nimble at writing music out. That is something I haven't had to do a lot of, and so I avoid it. And I know I'd get better at it if I just did it more. But I can read music just fine, and charts and such.
Well, that's awesome. So, what did you major in at East Tennessee State University? You might have said it, and I missed it there.
Oh, I didn't. I didn't. I took 5 years to get a 4-year degree, and I changed majors several times because I always thought I was going to be a teacher. From the time I was a little kid, I was enamored with the stories of Little House on the Prairie and Anne of Green Gables, and you know, both of those characters taught in one-room schoolhouses, and so I told my parents, I'm going to do that. And then I ended up becoming a professional musician instead. But I ended up majoring in public relations with a minor in music.
Okay. Well, you say in Little House on the Prairie, and you mentioned Mankato. I mean, that's part of that history, too, of Little House, too. Right, okay. Cool.
Oh, yeah. So I'm from St. James, Minnesota, and about an hour to the northwest of us is I was going to say Plum Creek. I'm blanking on it now. Walnut Grove, Minnesota. Sorry. Okay. Walnut Grove, Minnesota, where the Ingalls lived for a year or so, maybe a couple of years. We went to see the Jeffers Petroglyphs, which it's a great site. If you're ever in southern Minnesota in the summertime, you should stop by there. And it's all these, ancient rock drawings. And they're just right there on this windswept bit of prairie where there's like some exposed red rock. And it's gorgeous. But right at the edge of that property are some really deep wagon ruts. And, you know, the land's never been farmed because of the rocks there. And there's also a buffalo. You can see where the buffalo rubbed up against the rocks to get rid of their winter coat.
Oh, wow.
And they polished the rocks as smooth as glass. But those wagon ruts, the last time I was up there just a few years ago, I stood there and I was like, you know, Laura and her family traveled this road. You know, I'm looking at this wagon trail that they were on, and that was just really hit me hard. Wow. I love those stories. My dad read them to me as a kid, and we watched the TV show, and so, you know, all of that's very real to me because I'm from, you know, up that way where they spent quite a bit of time.
Right. Well, that's neat. Yeah, I always enjoyed watching that show, too. That's... I guess we probably came up sort of in the same time period because that was like a big show on TV back in those days for me.
Oh, yeah. I think it was already in reruns or starting to be in reruns by the time I was watching it.
Yeah.
But I love that my daughter is enjoying it.
Yeah, so absolutely.
It's important to me to be able to share that with her, especially since, you know, it's set in Minnesota, you know, where I'm from.
Yeah, exactly. Well, so you got your degree there at East Tennessee State University, and you'd already mentioned you played with your parents there in their band, so I'm guessing that was your first band experience. So did you play – well, in fact, I know you've played in other bands before starting your own band.
Can you
talk some about that?
Yes. Sure. So I – played for a short time with Becky Schlegel in True Blue. That was just the one summer there before I came down to Tennessee to go to school. And then while in school, I played with several of the bluegrass ensembles, got to go to France, got to play at the Kennedy Center. That was so special. Also played with Appalachian Trail, which is, they're out of East Tennessee, but they traveled quite a bit. We got to play some of the national folklife festivals in Lowell, Massachusetts, and Lansing, Michigan, and on the Mall in, I think I'm saying that right, on the Mall in D.C., And then right out of school, I took a job with Valerie Smith and Liberty Pike, and I was part of Val's band for 10 years, from 2001 to 2011. Got married in there, took a break because we were hoping that we would be able to have kids, and just needed a break from the road. And, of course, I say I'm living my life in reverse because, you know, you're supposed to, like, do your music career, have the kid, and then probably quit and stay home and take care of the kids and stuff. And we got pregnant with Romy, and then I took a job with Darren and Brooke Aldridge for two years. And they were so gracious about it. You know, they hired this massively pregnant woman to play fiddle for them, and they were really kind about it and helped me so much through that season. And I look back now and I'm like, how did I do that?
Yeah.
and how did they stand me, you know, for that time? But they were so sweet. They are wonderful vocalists. They're good people. And I am so excited for them and all the wonderful things that have been happening for them in the last couple of years. But I had to leave their band when Romy started walking. Our daughter is 7 now, but when she was about a year and a half, she started walking, and my husband was like, "We can't do this. You got to make your own schedule." And at that point, I had come out with the Tween Earth and Sky record on Dark Shadow Recording, and I needed to tour to sell that. And so I painted myself in a corner. I needed to start my own band, but it's been great. It's been 5 years now, and I have a wonderful group of guys around me, and I'm really blessed. They make it pretty easy on me as a band leader, and we just have a really good time. So it's Ned Lubarecki on the banjo. He's the 2018 IBMA Banjo Player of the Year. He's also on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. He does the More Banjo Sunday and the Derailed Show on Saturday night, and does a lot of teaching. And then Professor Dan Boner, who is the director of the East Tennessee State University Bluegrass Program, And Nate Lee on the mandolin. He's a 2015 IBMA Momentum Award winner. And then we have Daniel Harden on the bass. And Daniel works in the bottling plant at Jack Daniels in his hometown of Lynchburg, Tennessee. And they let him off to play music with us every so often.
Well, that's awesome. That's nice to have a job that's considerate like that and, you know, cut some slack for musicians to be able to go out and play also.
Yeah, all the guys in the band have of course, Dan works at the college, and Daniel works at Jack Daniels. Ned and Nate do a lot of teaching, and then I do some teaching, and, of course, my main gig is being Romy's mama.
Yeah, I'm sure that's a full-time gig right there in itself.
Yeah. It's pretty awesome. She's 7. I'm enjoying this stage right now at 7. I know it's going to change quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Especially when we get toward the teenage years. But so far, it's been pretty fun. It's been a whirlwind, but a blessing, a great blessing. Right now, it's really interesting, of course, with the pandemic on. We don't have school here in Manchester, Tennessee at the moment. But her teacher has been wonderful in sending us home things to work on. And so I'm getting a taste of homeschooling. I always thought that it's something I would like to do, and I'm gaining a whole new respect for all her teachers.
Yeah.
Here in they're pretty great.
Oh yeah. Well, kind of back up a minute. I know you also were a great clawhammer banjo player, and I know you play guitar too. What else do you play besides fiddle also?
I dabble in a lot of other things. Those are my main three instruments, and I usually play all of those during the course of one of our shows. Piano is actually my first instrument, and I'm trying to get my chops back on that, and have been having some fun with that here, especially in the last year or so, and trying to help Romy with her piano lessons too. It's just, I think it's just a great instrument to start on.
Yeah.
I got a good foundation in note reading and theory and stuff from learning piano. So I play that. I dabble on many other things, though. I was a percussionist in high school, and I play the bass a little bit, and kind of dabble on the mandolin, too. Well, dog paddle on the mandolin is probably more like it.
Oh, awesome. Well, you, like a lot of people, you play just about every instrument, it almost sounds like there. What got you into the clawhammer banjo?
Gillian Welch.
Okay, yeah. Well, that's a good one.
I just love her music. When I graduated from high school, my violin teacher, who I mentioned before, Patty Trias, gave me a cassette tape of Gillian's revival record, and she said, I think you'll like this. And it totally changed my life. I've been trying to write like Gillian Welch ever since. I just love her songwriting. And right now, off the top of my head, I can't remember if she played clawhammer on that record. I know she played clawhammer on Hell Among the Yearlings. And I just loved the sound of it. And so I picked it up because of that. So I feel like, you know, like the old-time players listen to me, and they're like, you're not really old-time. And the bluegrass players are like, oh, yeah, you're old-time. But I feel like I'm kind of neither fish nor fowl. I do some tunes on the clawhammer, but mostly I'll use it to back up songs.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. You saying that, mm-hmm. It's funny because, you know, I've been around old-time contests a lot, too, and bluegrass, or, you know, some of the fiddle conventions where they kind of just have a mixture of different contests and stuff, and a lot of the old-time clawhammer players, some of the players, you know, I was listening to some of them debate it backstage one time. They were talking about, if you didn't hold your thumb just right on the right hand, you weren't doing it right. You know? It didn't matter how it sounded great. You know, if you weren't holding that thumb exactly right, you know, then it wasn't right.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are purists in every genre of music, and that's good. We need them to carry the music on and to carry those traditions on. I learned to play clawhammer from Dr. Richard Blaustein at East Tennessee State University. He was an anthropology professor there. He's retired now, but he also taught old-time banjo and fiddle. So while, you know, Gillian was my inspiration to pick it up, you know, Dr. Blaustein taught me how to play, and I'm very grateful to him. But it's interesting, you know, the variance in the lick on the clawhammer banjo, you know, from different regions. Like I did some writing with Vicki Simmons of the New Coon Creek Girls. We wrote the song Queen of the Mountain Bootleggers together. And Vicki is an accomplished clawhammer player, but her lick is completely different than the lick that Dr. Blaustein taught me. Uh-huh. And, you know, it's still bum ditty, but it's different. And I can't play Vicky's style for you, but, you know, she's from around Berea, Kentucky. So
right.
I guess it's the lick from up that way. But it's good stuff, and I appreciate it all.
Oh yeah, me too.
And the banjo that I play most is a DP Hopkins clawhammer. It's built in Shelbyville, Tennessee, and it has a little bit of a tone ring in it, not like a full blown tone ring like a Scruggs style banjo, but just a little bit of oomph in there. And I love that because, you know, my show is pretty much bluegrass music, bluegrass Americana, and so we're a little louder than an old-time band.
Yeah.
And so it gives me just a little bit more zing, and I really like it.
Well, you answered one of my questions I was going to ask there, sort of. I was going to ask about your instruments, so that kind of tells us about your banjo there. What about your fiddle? I know I've seen a YouTube video where you did an interview, and you were talking about you got it at a car dealership. Is that right?
I did. It's true. A car dealership in Cleveland, Georgia, Universal Chevrolet.
Awesome.
And Mitch Simpson owns that dealership, and he's a fantastic mandolin player, and he deals in instruments upstairs. And at that time, they had festivals and concerts on the back lot of the car dealership. So I had come in to play with Val, and I tried some instruments, and we had been there recently, I can't remember the timeline exactly, but I had I had a guitar on loan from him, which is the guitar that I play. I'll talk about that in a second. But I was bringing the guitar back because I just thought, I can't justify buying this. I don't need it. And then he had this fiddle, and I played the fiddle for about 10 minutes. It had come in the day before from Aubrey Haney. He had brought a bunch of instruments on trade to get a Tahoe for his wife. And I played that fiddle for about 10 minutes, and I had to have it. I don't think I even played it in the key of B. I just loved it. Yeah. I loved the sound of it, and I've been playing it ever since. And Mitch was really great. I traded a fiddle, my main fiddle at the time, and had to kick in $500 and got the fiddle that I play now and my guitar. And I love them both. I'm dearly, they're family.
Right.
So my fiddle is around circa 1800, and it's a slightly smaller scale. It feels like it's slightly smaller scale than like a standard. It was built kind of right on the cusp of them having the standards for, you know, what a fiddle size or what the sizes on a fiddle should be. And it's just a little bit thinner body. It's a Stainer model, so it's German. There's no markings on the inside.
Okay.
And then I have a Garner Wilson bow that I usually play. It's an English-made bow. And I found out that also came in on trade from Aubrey Haney.
Okay.
Except that came to Minnesota to my friend Lloyd LaPlante. And I do play one of Lloyd's guitars. I don't always have that one on the road, but Lloyd builds fantastic instruments. Lloyd LaPlante from Grand Rapids, Minnesota. But he also trades in fiddles and bows, and so, you know, my main bow is I got from him. And then my guitar is a 1931 Gibson LO. So that's the one that I play on the shows mostly.
Right.
It's is that the mahogany guitar.
Yeah. Is that the black looking one?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You played that on the video too. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. I love those old Gibson guitars.
Yeah. It has a really fun voice.
Yeah, absolutely. And your fiddle, does it have a name?
Yes, my fiddle is Leopold, but we call him the old man.
Okay.
Because he's old.
Yeah. Where did the name Leopold come from, can I ask?
I had just seen the movie Kate and Leopold.
Okay.
And I really liked Hugh Jackman's character. So, you know, it's kind of the fiddle sort of named after Hugh Jackman.
Okay. Well, hey, that's a cool name, I think.
Yeah, especially for an old German thing.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk about your songwriting, too. I printed off some of the songs that you've written from your website here and the different artists, and it's, my goodness, it's like a who's who of artists here that have recorded your songs, and I know you've recorded your own songs, too, besides these other artists. Talk to us a little bit about your songwriting. When did you first start writing songs?
Oh, I've been writing songs for as long as I can remember. And before I was writing, singing songs, I was trying to write instrumental stuff. And I remember debuting something from Mrs. Munson's sixth grade music class. And, she gave me a blow pop as a treat, you know, for playing one of my original songs for the class. And she said, "This is a magical musical moment."
Awesome.
And, but I remember writing songs while, push mowing the yard, at home. That was my job. And it was great because, you know, you could sing and holler and nobody heard you, you know?
Yeah.
You could just, get all your thoughts out. And,
yeah.
And, one of the songs that I wrote, then I brought it to the family band, and our bass player, Roxy, she liked it, and she said some nice things about it. And then I found out years later that I ripped off the melody from Rock, Salt, and Nails.
Oh, yeah.
Which is such a great song, you know. But yeah. I didn't know at the time that I was doing that. But I tell people, you know, that's actually a great exercise, you know. Take a melody that you like a lot. Like, or a song that you like a lot, and just take the melody and write some different lyrics to it. And, you know, that's kind of a gateway into learning how to write songs.
Right.
I'm so blessed, and I'm continually just just amazed at the people that have recorded my songs. I'm so grateful for that, and so grateful for the DJs that play the music out there and support independent music. And thank you for doing this podcast.
Oh, well, thank you. I am sure enjoying talking to you and getting your thoughts on music. Well, how many songs have you written, probably all together? Do you even know?
I don't. Honestly, I don't know. I mean, I've got, over 100 or so that are registered with BMI, but I know there's more out there than that, because I usually don't register the stuff with BMI unless it's going to be performed out or it's being recorded or, or I'm going to record it. So I don't know. But I would say probably several hundred songs.
Right. Well, that's awesome. I know you write songs solo sometimes, and you also write with co-writers. What determines which way you're going to go on that? If you get an idea sometimes, do you think this is one I'm going to develop on my own, or do you get an idea and think of someone else that you would like to work with on it sometimes? How does that work for you?
Both, actually. I keep a running list on my phone of song ideas, and sometimes an idea will make me think, hey, that would be a good one to write with so-and-so, or that would be a good idea to try to write for a certain artist. And then there are some ideas where I'm like, no, this is too personal. This is something I want to record myself. And really just in the last, I guess since 2013, I've been able, I started my band at the top of 2015, but, started working with Dark Shadow Recording in 2013. And now I'm getting to record more than I ever had before. I mean, I had, couple albums released before I started working with Dark Shadow Recording, but now I'm recording more, and so I'm having to kind of set stuff aside a little bit more, thinking, I'm going to need stuff for another record. A lot of the songs that are coming out on this new record it's a mix. Some of them are pretty old, and I've had them set aside, and some are new, and have some co-writes with some really fun people, including Eric Gibson from the Gibson Brothers, Donna Ulysses, John Weisberger, and I'm blanking on the rest, but it's going to be a really fun album. But I do still like writing on my own. It's hard for me now, being a band leader and a mom and, everything else that I'm doing. It's really hard for me to quiet my brain down and take that time and do the songwriting, which I love writing songs.
Yeah.
And it's just such a part of me. And I think really from an early age, it's been my therapy, my way of dealing with the world and the craziness around me, and just kind of, working through things. Sometimes the songs are for that. Sometimes it's just purely to tell whatever story. I get a little fidgety when I haven't been writing.
Yeah.
And so having the co-writing appointments is good for me, because it forces me to either, when I'm able to, drive up to Nashville and meet with somebody and write, I block out that time and I go have that writing appointment, and I'm focused on that for 4 hours or something. That's very helpful to me. When I'm left on my own at the house, there's 1,000 things that probably need to be done before I sit down and write a song. So having the co-writing appointments has been really, really helpful in the last several years.
Yeah.
And also, it helps you grow as a writer, because you learn stuff from your co-writers every time you get together.
How far are you from Nashville?
We live just exactly an hour from downtown. So we live in Manchester, Tennessee, which is halfway between Nashville and Chattanooga on I-24. And if you've heard of the Bonnaroo Music Festival, this is the home of that festival. And our house is about half a mile over the interstate as the crow flies from the Bonnaroo ground.
You're listening to Acoustic Music Talk with your host, Brad Apple.
Well, how many dates do you play a year, Becky?
Yeah, it kind of averages to maybe 40 dates a year. We don't play as much as some groups because we all have day jobs, and so we're pretty much weekend warriors.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I just have to be real careful about not taking too much because, you know, just to keep peace at home.
Yeah.
Because like I said before, my main gig is that I'm Romy's mama. But yeah, around 40 dates a year. Of course, you know, this year, our dates have pretty much gone away for June and July. Looks like, you know, right now August is holding on, and I'm keeping that all updated on my website, BeckyBuller.com, and Buller is spelled just like it sounds, B as in boy, U-L-L-E-R, BeckyBuller.com, and just go there and check out our tour schedule, and hopefully we can see y'all down the road somewhere soon when we can all get back together and don't have to worry about this whole virus.
Yeah. I think we're all ready for it to go away.
Oh, yeah. Everybody I've talked to is going stir crazy.
Yeah. It'd probably be kind of hard to sing with a face mask on at a festival.
True.
Yeah.
We always bring our own microphones, and we have a wonderful sound man, TJ Garskoff, who travels with us. So, yeah, I mean, we wear a face mask to the stage.
Yeah.
I don't know. We have to figure that out.
Yeah. Let me ask you this, back to your songs. Do you have a favorite song maybe that you've written?
Well, oh my gosh, that changes daily. Can I talk about the new one?
I've
got a new single out.
Oh yes, absolutely.
So, and I love this song, and I wrote this with Linda Dawson from Raleigh, North Carolina, and it's the confluence of three true stories. So there's a lot of truth in it, but it's fiction.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of truth in it. So it's called The Barber's Fiddle, and the main idea for this song came from someone that came up to me at Dollywood years ago and just told me the story about a barber in his hometown that had wanted to be a professional fiddle player and tried it, and it just didn't work out, and so he came home and he needed a haircut so he could be presentable when he showed up at his parents' doorstep. And so he tried to hawk his fiddle to get a haircut. So that's the main body of this song. And then we used the real life Gene Boyd from the Star Barber Shop in Bristol, Virginia as our barber.
Uh-huh.
And I got to know Gene when I was out at East Tennessee State University going to school, and Gene kind of took me under his wing, and I'm just so happy we finished this song and I got to play it for him before he passed away. I didn't get it recorded. That's been several years ago. I finally got it recorded now. And it's the first single from this new record that's coming out on Dark Shadow Recording. The third, influence on this song was a man that I didn't get to meet. His name was Mr. Billy Womack. He was the fiddle and barber in Woodbury, Tennessee. And he was very influential, on my Tennessee family, on their music. He played music with my father-in-law. He taught my brother-in-law to play guitar. Was big buddies with Kenny Baker, John Hartford, Benny Martin. Everybody came through that barber shop back in the day. So this is a tribute to Mr. Billy too, and then the production of it, it's my band playing on the track, and then we have 18 fiddlers on it, and a few of them are singing with me, telling this story, and that's Jason Carter, Katie Penn, Sam Bush, Lori Lewis, and Sean Camp. And then our other fiddlers include Stuart Duncan, Michael Cleveland, Laura Orshaw, Deanie Richardson, Bronwyn Keith Hines, Johnny Warren playing his dad Paul Warren's fiddle.
Oh, wow.
And Tyler and Brian and Fred, all from the violin shop in Nashville, and Jason Berry, and I feel like I'm missing somebody. I think that's everybody. And then, of course, myself and Professor Dan and Nate from the Becky Buller Band, we're all kicking off the tune, and we're ending it with triple fiddles.
Wow, that's awesome. That's like a who's who of everybody almost there.
Oh, yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It's absolutely crazy, but we've been calling it a celebration of the fiddle and of passing down the music from one generation to the next. And I just love it. I tell people, you really have to pay attention. And the more you pay attention, the more song ideas you're going to get. you know, because the ideas just come from everywhere, and you got to be a good listener too, and that's a lost art these days. Everybody wants to be heard, but
yeah,
there aren't as many listeners as there used to be. So I encourage you folks out there that are you know, honing their craft as a songwriter, I just want to encourage you to just really listen and then write those ideas down. And the more you do that, the more you're going to tune your radar in, and you're just going to hear song ideas everywhere. And that particular idea was just gift wrapped. You know, the gentleman who told me that story just, you know, handed me everything I needed, really,
<All right. laughs>
to write that song. But it did take a few years to come to fruition. And yeah, it definitely took getting together with my friend Linda Dawson, who's just a magical writer. Just, you know, check out her music, Linda Dawson.
Well, Becky, you and I have been talking about your single, The Barber's Fiddle. And I was wondering, I know you don't have your band with you, but I was wondering if you might could do us kind of a stripped down solo version of The Barber's Fiddle.
I'm going to do a quarantine version of my new single, The Barber's Fiddle, and I hope you'll check out the recorded version of this. You can find it anywhere you do your downloading or your streaming. It features my band, the Becky Buller Band, along with 18 guest fiddlers. I wrote it with Linda Dawson. Again, this is called The Barber's Fiddle. Mr. Jean's Barbershop, State Street, the Virginia side. I walked in hand with Pa, 5 years old and terrified. Mr. Jean smiled at me, helped me up into the chair. In the mirror I could see an old red fiddle hanging there. The gray-haired barber caught my gaze, said that's a tale I like to tell, of a young man who came in one day with a fiddle and a dream to sell. He tried to live out on the road, thought music was where he belonged. Well, it broke his heart and it broke his soul, made him sing a different song. Fiddle up high, fiddle down low, fiddle most everywhere I go. I'd fiddle until my dying day, if I could make a life on a fiddler's pay. He sat in this very chair, scared of what his folks would say. His hope was gone, his pockets bare. They warned him it would end this way. He returned to start anew, no money for shave and trim. He asked, would this fiddle do? Said it wasn't any use to him. Fiddle up high, fiddle down low, fiddle most everywhere I go. I'd fiddle until my dying day, if I could make a life on a fiddler's pay. Mr. Jean swept the floor, spun me around and said, you're done. I begged him to tell me more, what happened to the wayward son? Turns out it was Mr. Jean hung his fiddle up that day. And now I'm living out his dream, because he taught me how to play. Fiddle up high, fiddle down low, fiddle most everywhere I go. I'm gonna fiddle until my dying day, if I can make a life on a fiddler's pay. Fiddle up high, fiddle down low, fiddle most everywhere I go. I'm gonna fiddle until my dying day, if I can make a life on a fiddler's pay. Living my life on a fiddler's pane.
You're listening to Acoustic Music Talk with your host, Brad Apple.
You kind of alluded to it a minute ago, I think, but for the listeners out there, you have a video on this particular song, too, the Barber's Fiddle, too, correct?
We do, and it's beautifully put together by Stephen Mogin, who is also the producer of this record. He has a way with audio and with video. We did some scenes at Cutshaw's Barbershop here in Manchester, Tennessee, and Adam Cutshaw and his son Buzz are the two that are walking into the barbershop at the beginning of the video, and then Ray Seckler is our barber in the video. Ray's dad, Curly Seckler, was part of Flat and Scrug and the Foggy Mountain Boys, and Ray is my neighbor here in Manchester, Tennessee, so I was just thrilled that he stood in as our Mr. Jean in the video. And then Pastor Jake Dorak, he's our older version of the young fiddler, you know, he comes in at the end, you know, to visit Mr. Jean. And then Stephen incorporated all sorts of studio shots of all of our 18 fiddlers are featured in the video. So he just did a great job putting all that together. And I hope folks will go to either my webpage, click on the video button. It'll be the first video that you see. And again, my webpage is BeckyBuller.com. Or go to YouTube, our YouTube channel. It's there. It's on the Dark Shadow Recording channel. Please check it out and hope you enjoy it.
And for those who follow you on Facebook, maybe this is on YouTube also, but I know on your Facebook page, you actually sat down at your computer monitor and you broke the video down for everybody, like who was doing what and everything. That was really cool, too. I enjoyed that.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me. I've got to share that again. And there's going to be some more videos, too, just following along, telling the story behind this song and the people that we're honoring with this song. So just be on the lookout for that. And you can get to all of our social media pages from my webpage. Again, that's BeckyBuller.com. But please follow us. We do lots of fun stuff on there. Lots of stuff from that all of the band members are doing individually as well as together. So lots of fun videos and things. We try to keep it light and fun.
Yeah. You mentioned one of your favorite songwriters being Gillian Welch. Who would be some of your other favorite songwriters that you have?
Oh, definitely James Taylor and Daryl Scott, Tim Stafford from Blue Highway. I've had the great honor of getting to write with him some. And I tell people, you know, Tim kind of taught me how to write. I mean, you know, listening to his songs on the Blue Highway record. And so getting to write with him has been just a huge thrill for me. Oh my gosh, other writers, so many. Sean Colvin and Patty Griffin, Annie Herring from the second chapter of Acts. I grew up listening to a lot of Jesus People rock music. Uh-huh. Larry Norman, continuing in that vein. And I could go on and on.
Do you like any of Mary Chapin Carpenter stuff?
Oh, you know, her song John Wilkes Booth that she wrote for Tony Rice, that's featured on the Native American record, is brilliant. Oh, absolutely brilliant. I'm getting goosebumps just talking about it. That whole Native American record, I've literally left that in my CD player for months on end, and I'm completely happy just listening to it over and over again. Such a beautiful album.
You're listening to Acoustic Music Talk with your host, Brad Apple.
The Barber's Fiddle, is that coming off a project that's already out or is about to come out here shortly?
So The Barber's Fiddle is our first single from my new album called Distance and Time, and that's coming out September 18th. We've just moved that release date back. We were going to release it in July, but we're just unable to because of the current situation. And I think it's ironic and slightly hilarious that we chose that title, Distance and Time, which is it's a line in one of the songs. But when we chose it, we had no idea what was coming.
Yeah.
But we're all keeping our distance, and we all just need time.
Hey, I noticed another kind of a milestone of, you know, if things don't change with this pandemic and everything, a date that you've got, you're debuting at the Grand Ole Opry pretty soon. Is that right?
Yes, we're supposed to debut at the Grand Ole Opry on May 30th, and not sure what to expect. Nashville, at the time that we're recording this, Nashville is still under a stay-at-home order until mid-May. So, things are changing daily and hourly, but I'm really hoping that we'll get to do that as scheduled. And folks can catch the Opry on Circle TV. It's on Antenna TV now. A lot of places have it. I know my parents have it in Minnesota. We're watching it here in Manchester, Tennessee. But that's been a great thing. I've been enjoying watching Hee Haw reruns, on there. And all the great music programming they have. We've enjoyed that so much. That I'm not sure when that came online, but it's not been very long ago. So I'm thrilled that, that's part of the deal, doing the Opry these days is you get to be on Circle TV as well. So, as of right now, it's still on. And I just keep an eye on my website and I will announce if anything changes with that. But I'm just thrilled that they called and, so my husband played the Opry back in the 90s when he was with a group called the Big Creek Band from here in Manchester. And so he's always held it over me that I've gotten to do lots of stuff, but he's gotten to play the Opry. He got to play the Opry before I did. So he'll always have that on me.
Yeah.
But the band and I are really looking forward to it.
Yeah, you bet. That's an awesome milestone to look forward to there. Recording. I was going to ask you about that too. You do a lot of your recording now at the Dark Shadow Recording. That's Stephen Mogin. Is that correct?
Yes, it is Stephen Mogin. And Stephen is the guitar player for the Sam Bush Band and has been part of that group since, I think, 2006. And he's been a friend of mine for a lot longer than that. And, we used to work together in Valerie Smith's band years and years ago. And he's really good at what he does, and I'm blessed to get to work with him and to call him and his wife Yana friends. He has a great space now. He finally has his own studio there in Goodlettsville, and it's beautiful, and he gets wonderful tones.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about recording. You may or may not have a certain setup you like when you're recording, or do you just you go with what the engineer wants to do a lot of times, or do you have a preferred microphone or microphones that you record vocal, fiddle, banjo with?
So I'm going to try to pull that up right now. I'm not a gearhead like some of these folks. Like, Mojo is a complete gearhead, of course, and that's why he's a great engineer. And I'm not good with that, but I can tell you exactly what he had me through. He had me through a Mic Tech CV3 into a Mic Tech MPA Pre, into Highland Dynamics BG2 comp.
Okay.
So hopefully them know what that means. So that's on my voice. And then we have a Neumann KM84 into a Mic Tech MPA for my fiddle.
Okay. That's good equipment.
So there you go.
Yeah. Awesome.
Yes. I wish I was better with all that stuff. I should know more than I do. And honestly, I've done quite a bit of recording. I haven't done as much recording as some folks out there. So and I've always been more of a live performer. So going into the studio is, it's still like kind of, I imagine like going to the moon or something for me.
Yeah.
It's like, whoa, I'm on a different planet.
Well, is recording a process you enjoy?
Yes and no. I mean, I feel like I'm getting more comfortable with it. It's just hard, when you hear everything on the Jumbotron and it's really a head game to say, okay, no, this is good enough. This is fine. This is good for today.
Yeah.
It's okay. So yeah, I'm getting there with it. And Mojo is good to work with.
Yeah. So. Does he kind of fill a producer's role too, or do you do that? Or
oh yes, yeah. No. He's the producer on the record.
Okay.
He gives me a lot of input, or allows me a lot of input on arrangements and stuff. But the band is involved in the arrangements. Stephen is especially good with the vocal arranging and great band coach too. If anybody out there needs a good band coach, definitely drop Mojo a line. Go to his website, darkshadowrecording.com, and to find out more about what he does with the band coaching. And I've hired him to coach my band. And even though we're all seasoned professionals, you know, there's still things that Mojo noticed that we were doing that, you know, once we were made aware of them, we could kind of like, you know, make our, well, like, you know, make our stage show better. So I'd encourage anybody to take some time and work with a coach to just help up your game.
Yeah, it's sort of like working with a co-writer, like you talked about earlier. You can always get ideas from someone on the outside, kind of looking in and learn from their thoughts on stuff too. So, Becky, I understand you have a new single coming out right away. Can you tell us some about that?
Sure. This is one of two covers tunes that we're doing on the new record, and this is a little bit more toward the progressive side of things. It's actually a song by Need to Breathe, if anybody's familiar with that fantastic Christian group. And this song is called More Heart, Less Attack. And I just love it. One of my students brought it to me and asked me to teach her how to sing and play it on guitar. And I just fell in love with the song. And I just thought, well, this would make a great bluegrass song. And the guys were with me on it. And the message is just so positive. And, you know, just about, it's a message of hope and striving to be light and life and love to those around you. And I just love the message. And I don't think it's a coincidence that we were led to record this song and release it during this time that we didn't see coming. So I hope people enjoy our version of More Heart, Less Attack.
Right. And when did you say this single is going to drop again?
It actually dropped May 1st.
May 1st. Okay.
Yeah. So it's currently available everywhere you do your downloading or your streaming. Please check it out.
All right. Is there plans for a video on this song?
There are. We were going to record a video back in March, and of course that didn't happen because of the pandemic, but we are working on plan B, and as soon as they lift the stay-at-home order in Nashville, we're going to make that happen.
Okay. Well, Becky, thank you again so much for being on the show. We've sure enjoyed it, and our best wishes to you on your music, and keep turning out the great music like you've been doing. We sure, as listeners, enjoy hearing it.
Well, Brad, thank you again for having me, and bless you again for supporting independent music. And I just thank you guys out there for listening, and I just pray that everybody stays well and happy and healthy in the midst of all this, and we'll see you down the road real soon.
Well, folks, that's it for our show this week. Again, we'd like to thank Miss Becky Buller for being on our show. And I'd like to invite you back here next week. We'll have another great show lined out for you. Until then, please visit us at our website, acousticmusictalk.com. If you haven't caught up with all of our podcasts, they're listed on that website. And find us at Facebook at Acoustic Music Talk, and please like and follow us there. Until next week, I'm your host, Brad Apple. Stay safe, and we'll see you back here.
Thank you for listening to Acoustic Music Talk. Join us again next week for another episode as we continue to explore the world of acoustic music.